The New Dominion, everything Virginia. Politics, economy, society, pop culture, sports, and more. And it's on the air. From our studios in the Shenandoah Valley, it's The New Dominion Show.
Welcome to The New Dominion Show. I'm Chris Graham. We were able to catch up with Mark Warner yesterday. Mark Warner, the former governor of Virginia, of course, running for the United States Senate, running for that Democratic nomination, expected to have a clear sailing path to that. It looked like he'll be running against Jim Gilmore, the former Republican governor of Virginia. Jim Gilmore does have an obstacle in his way to the nomination. I'm sure maybe a minor obstacle. Bob Marshall, the Virginia delegate, member of the House of Delegates from Virginia, also competing for that nomination. But looks like it'll be Mark Warner against Jim Gilmore, the last, at least back-to-back governors there, kind of duking it out over things. Mark Warner was at JMU yesterday. We were able to catch up with him there to actually take part in listening to and recording some of what he had to say during a rally sponsored by the JMU College Democrats. And then we talked with him afterwards for a few minutes about some of the issues of the day in Virginia politics and national politics. And we'll be able to share that with you here and issues touched on, including immigration, health care, the war in Iraq, energy policy, which is a big focal point for the former governor. As he says, you'll hear him say in just a little bit in the show, he's a new convert, but he has a zeal of a new convert as far as that goes. So a lot here from Mark Warner. This will really help you maybe get an early feel for where he stands on the issues of the day in his campaign here in January, 11 months from the big election. So I hope you take advantage of this. We'll be right back after this with some comments from Mark Warner during his rally yesterday here on the New Dominion Show. The New Dominion Magazine, available in print in the Valley and Central Virginia. Find out more at thenewdominion.com.
You don't have to go all the way to Greenfront. Fine furnishings are now available in Fishersville. Stop by our store and get a free gift when you make your first purchase of $30 or more. As a bonus, you'll be registered to win $500 in free furnishings just for registering to receive our HomeSense newsletter. Home Innovations is located on Route 250 in Fishersville, across from the Augusta County Library. Home Innovations, turning the house you have into the home you've always dreamed of.
It's back, and it's like you've never seen it before. The January 2008 edition of the New Dominion Magazine marks the debut of our new glossy full-color look. With a cover story breaking down the obscenity case in Stanton, a look inside economic trends in Waynesboro, interviews with TV and radio mainstays, a look at rural Virginia politics, and a few minutes in an MMA cage. And it's free. The New Dominion Magazine is available at locations throughout the Valley in Central Virginia. To find out more, go to thenewdominion.com. Thenewdominion.com.
Everything Virginia, the New Dominion, www.thenewdominion.com.
Welcome back to the New Dominion Show. I'm Chris Graham. Mark Warner addressing JMU College Democrats yesterday, talking about a couple of things here at the beginning. We'll just start off with why he's deciding to run for the U.S. Senate. Of course, he also addresses here his decision to drop out of the presidential race and has a little fun with that in addition. But why he's running for this job, as he likes to say, as he likes to frame it, why he's asking to be hired to serve as our U.S. Senator.
In frigid New Hampshire, I was taking my youngest daughter to the Hannah Montana concert. Actually, maybe New Hampshire looked better than the Hannah Montana. But when I decided not to pursue national office, at least at this point in my life, I did come to the decision fairly soon afterwards that come January of 2009, we are going to have a new president, obviously. I hope it's a Democrat. But regardless, that new president is going to need people in the United States Senate who are going to be about trying to get things done. And my goal, if I could get hired for this position, and I know there's a lot of the folks who sponsored or came today are with the JMU Young Democrats, and I'm grateful for your support and the fact that you guys are here. But my goal, if I got elected, was not just to go up there and be one more vote for the Democratic Party, but to go to the United States Senate and try to actually put together, this will sound perhaps a little naive, but it's what I hope to do, is put together a group of 8, 10, 12 senators, bipartisan senators, that would try to create a new radical centrist bloc in the United States Senate. Because my fear is that if we're going to get our country fixed, there are a whole host of problems in this country that are so big that are going to require such transformative change that unless we can show to the American people that not only we have the right ideas, but that there's some level of kind of cross-party line support, then I'm not sure we're going to be able to make the change. I obviously hope that we're going to have a Democratic president and a Democratic House, but my fear is that, or concern would be that I don't want the Democrats, when they're in power, to try to react with the same kind of, I think, arrogance that has demonstrated a lot of the last 6 or 7 years in this country. And the notion of trying to put together this radical centrist coalition that would hopefully work with the new Democratic president to get things done would be very exciting. And the reason why I think we're so needed is, I just had a birthday the other day. I'm 53 now, which I hate to acknowledge. But in my life, I can't think of a time when there are more issues that, unless we have some real serious debate and some real serious solutions, that could, if we don't fix some of these issues, then America's standing in the world, I think, will dramatically change. You know, I would argue over the last 7 or 8 years, other than respond to 9/11 and invade Iraq, there's very little that we can point to in terms of where America has taken major action around issues of competitiveness, around issues of health care, around issues of our standing in the world, around issues related to energy. This host of issues, and I like to use the analogy that it's sort of like snowballs that have been ignored, and they're rolling down the hill, picking up momentum, and at some point, these snowballs are going to become an avalanche. And our ability to fix this nation and to get it back to the right, I think the right standing in the world, and to make sure that you all have the same kind of opportunities that I had coming out of college close to 30 years ago, you know, that may, could very well be in jeopardy.
Now I want to give you a little bit more from Mark Warner, more on his decision to run for the Senate, why he's running for the Senate, what he wants to do if he's elected, and we'll give you some more on that.
There was sometimes a little suspicion of me, you know, because I've been a business guy for 20 years. I was from Virginia. I worked in a bipartisan, you know, I worked in a bipartisan way. They knew I had a 2-to-1 Republican legislature, and I worked together. So there was always this effort to try to kind of check out my Democratic bona fides. You know, I'd get asked in one form or another this same question almost every place. It would always be, all right, Governor, all right, Warner, tell us what you dislike most about President Bush. You know, expecting me to kind of go for the red meat and gosh, there's a lot of differences I've got with the president. But my answer was always this, and what I hope some of our national candidates would start talking about. I have a lot of policy differences with the president. Before that, I could go down energy just one, Iraq war, lack of competitiveness plans, healthcare, you name it, I've got problems, policy differences with the president. But my biggest concern with the president is not the policy differences. My biggest concern with this president is I don't think he is trusted enough in the character of the American people, in our ability to respond at moments of crisis with a little bit of shared sacrifice if somebody makes a big ask. Now, I was running for governor when 9/11 happened, and then became governor a couple months later. There was such a spirit in this country. There was nothing I think the American people wouldn't have done in response to 9/11. If there had been a call that would have said, we're going to decrease our commitment to foreign oil by 75% in 5 years, American people would have said, sign me. But that moment passed. If after Hurricane Katrina, there would have been a call that would have said, this is an embarrassment. We're not only going to rebuild New Orleans, but we're going to rebuild America's infrastructure, which, by the way, we've had a 50% decrease in investment in since the 1970s as a percentage of our GDP. And we see it, God knows anybody that drives on I-81, say a little prayer so the trucks don't run you over. But, you know, whether it's our roads, whether it's the fact that we're turning into a second or third world nation in terms of our rail infrastructure, the fact that we are 15th in the world at this point in broadband deployment. If there had been a call instead after Katrina to say, hey, we're going to no longer build bridges to nowhere and do pork barrel infrastructure, but we're going to have a 21st century infrastructure plan for this country, I think Americans would have said, sign me up. And the one thing that I found as I looked at national office, and what I hope and pray will, that one of these national candidates, hopefully a Democratic candidate, will galvanize, is I think Americans know that we're at one of these critical tipping points in our country's history. that we got a window to get it right. That if we're going to get it right, it's going to take all of us in some form of united action. This isn't the first time this happened. I mean, my gosh, in the last 100 years, we all are sure studying history in one level or another. You go back from the threat of World War II to rebuilding Europe to the question of Russia when they launched Sputnik and the scientific and technological exchange, or Reagan taking on communism. There's been a half dozen times in the last 100 years where this country has had moments of great crisis where the character of the American people have been called upon to step up, and they've done the right thing. And that's one of those times again right now. And my biggest complaint with this president, he's not made that appeal. It's all been about politics. It's all been about partisanship. It's all been about demonizing folks that you disagree with. And what I hope that if I get hired for this job, that I in some small way can be one of those guys and gals that will be in Washington and less about scoring partisan points and more about trying to make that call to arms. Because we live in a pretty wild time. We live in a pretty extraordinary time. We live in a time where places like India and China are not playing for second place and going to suddenly cede, America's right to be the preeminent power forever just because we happen to be Americans. It's a time we're going to have to step up. And I appreciate the fact that you all care enough about your community and Commonwealth and country to come out and hear an unemployed politician job applicant. But I hope in some small way I can be part of making that call to step up and doing my part to roll up my sleeves and try to get it done.
Now, we were able to catch up, I mentioned this earlier, with Mark Warner after the rally and ask him a few questions. And the first one that came to my mind was, you might have heard him talk just a little bit earlier in his segment, about how he wants to start a radical centrist coalition, or at least be involved in the formation of one in the Senate if he's elected, a radical centrist coalition of Democrats and Republicans who can maybe bring policy back towards the middle, away from the two fringes, the liberal and conservative fringes of American politics. And I wanted to get more on this idea from him.
It's driven by people who are saying, we're tired of partisanship. We want to get the thing fixed. They know in their gut that we can do better than this. And I think it's the wave that's coming.
And the power that it could have would be to take our policies in a direction away from those partisan directions.
Because my fear as a Democrat is that if, and I hope, we have a Democratic president, Democratic House, increase the numbers in the Senate. But the worst thing for the Democrats, and more importantly for the country, would be if the Democrats got control of everything and then came in with the same kind of arrogance the Republicans had for the first 6 years of
right.
The Senate. Payback should not be a national goal. It should be, how do we get our country fixed?
Right.
And I think there's a lot of this can be driven partially driven by, how do you build those relations? I think I showed I could do a little bit of that when I was governor with the Republican legislature. I think, when I was chairman of the national governors, heck, we got 46 governors to agree on something. Got blasted by both sides.
Right.
So you hear there from Mark Warner about why he's running for the job of U.S. Senator. After the break, we'll come back and we'll talk about his policies on the Iraq War and his feelings on what the United States needs to do in regard to Iraq. Coming up after this on the New Dominion Show. The New Dominion Magazine, available in print in the Valley and Central Virginia. Find out more at thenewdominion.com. Back by popular demand. Well, sorta, kinda. Stop the Presses will change your life. And it's actually a collection of humor columns by author Chris Graham. That's me. I had a hard time narrowing them down, so you get 98 of them. And every one of them can be read while you're taking care of business. More information at authorchrisgraham.com. That's authorchrisgraham.com.
Links to blogs from across the Commonwealth. The place to go to see what people are saying. The New Dominion, www.thenewdominion.com.
Welcome back to the New Dominion Show. I'm Chris Graham. Again, we're talking about Mark Warner. He was in Harrisonburg yesterday at JMU talking with JMU College Democrats. And he talked during the forum that he held there with JMU College Democrats about his thoughts on the policy towards Iraq. And he addresses some of those issues right here.
Probably put me somewhere between Clinton and Obama. I actually believe that part of the long-term solution to Iraq is a 21st century energy policy, because I do believe that one of the reasons we're in Iraq is about oil. I think that our troops have done an extraordinary job. As governor, seeing off the guard and having them come back and sitting and talking about what they've had to go through over there is enormous amounts of courage and enormous service. But I don't think there was ever a question the American military might could defeat Iraqi resistance. What has so disturbed me is that in this so-called breathing space, we've seen nothing from this Maliki government in terms of the Iraqis stepping up. And while it's great that you've got some of the Sunni tribesmen now who are not shooting at us, but are we simply, if there's not reconciliation, are we simply arming the Sunnis against the Shias for what will be the eventual civil war? And, I think we have to start bringing our troops home so we can put pressure on the Iraqis to step up and hold them to the time, the very, even if we simply use the requirements that President Bush set out a year ago and actually said, we're going to hold you to those requirements. He laid out things, split up the oil, take over more security, show a deep application program, and they've not done basically any of it. So let's start bringing our troops home. I don't think you can put a deadline on the back end, but start bringing our troops home, put the pressure on the Iraqis, much, much more emphasis on a diplomatic effort that has to engage the balance of the region. And, we want to send the broadside about America's intent to not be as dependent on the region. You make some pretty dramatic changes around energy policy, you're going to get a whole lot of people's attention from that region.
Again, after the forum, we were able to catch up with Mark Warner. I wanted to press him on this issue, get a chance to have him share more of his feelings on Iraq and on a particular couple of issues as well. My feeling, personally, is that no matter how much any policymaker wants to say we're going to pull our troops out right away, it's going to be difficult, and I wanted to get his thoughts on that.
A centrist bipartisan solution to Iraq. I know a question was asked in there, and you talked in depth about the solution to the Iraq. A problem that I have, or a question that I have, is that no matter how sincere we are about wanting to remove troops from Iraq, that we may be stuck there against our wishes for a long time. I look at Korea, for example. We've been there for half a century, and we're no closer
to a solution.
That's
why I think you can't put... I think we've kind of been stuck with the stay-the-course approach of Bush for an unlimited period of time, or out tomorrow. Neither one of those are going to work. I do think the only way, though, you kind of shock therapy the Iraqis into some action is by starting to show you're serious about you're not going to be there to simply be the referee forever. Now, that where I'm also at is, and it's interesting to see where, at least I think some of the more responsible Democratic candidates have been, Clinton and Obama, they want to start, but they're not putting that,
right,
that, every troop out, regardless of circumstance, by date X. As much as that might be politically popular to say right now, because you gotta, there is a little bit of the fact. What was it? Colin Powell said the Conrad. What's the rule? The Pier 1.
The Pottery Barn rule.
Pottery Barn. Yeah. You broke it. Well,
You turn to fix it.
We gotta be there some level of fixing it. But they gotta help fix it, and we're not seeing that so far.
You hear there from Mark Warner on the Iraq War. Coming up after the break, we're going to talk about immigration policy, another national issue that's had a lot of our attention the last few years. Next on the New Dominion Show. Stop the presses. News from a different angle. Fridays at thenewdominion.com.
University of Virginia basketball has moved across the street, but U-Haul lore lives on. Mad About You, four decades of basketball at University Hall, an inside look at UVA basketball. More information at madaboutyou.net. Madaboutyou.net. Get your copy today.
The New Dominion Magazine, available in print in the Valley and Central Virginia. Find out more at thenewdominion.com. Welcome back to the New Dominion Show. I'm Chris Graham. Mark Warner in Harrisonburg yesterday, talking with JMU College Democrats, and a question comes up from the audience about particular immigration policy. In particular, the question that was asked had to do with the Federal Dream Act that's been proposed that would allow children of undocumented workers or undocumented immigrants in general to apply and receive in-state tuition benefits in places across the country. Mark Warner used that as he talked about that issue particularly, and then he went beyond that to talk in general about his thoughts on immigration policy. You'll hear from him here.
Back in 2003, I believe, 2004, I can't recall, there was a legislation to try to prohibit any undocumented person from getting any kind of participation in Virginia colleges and universities. And I said, listen, I think we need to enforce our immigration laws. I think we need to have more secure borders and find a way for employers to check out somebody's legal status. And I also understand, don't like the Lou Dobbsian version of America that's being played out there that's hateful in some ways, but I also think there is a very real concern if, you know, you work hard all your life and you live in a suburban home and you've got, you know, 15 people who are undocumented living next door, that's wrong too. What I did with, when they tried to pass that in Virginia was I almost kind of a variation on the Dream Act. I said, you know, I think that folks ought to be able to get Virginia in-state tuition if you were, even if you were undocumented, if you were a person who had gone to Virginia high school for 5 years and graduated from a Virginia high school. If your parents could prove they paid taxes for the last 3 years. So it's not like, you know, somebody who would come here and their family wasn't contributing, you had to prove that you were paying taxes. You had to obviously not have any kind of, you know, criminal background or anything else like that. And if you were in the process of trying to become legal, which again seemed to me, I'm the first kid in my family to ever graduate from college. And I'm standing before you today, well, thank God for student loans, I wouldn't be here, you know, but because I got a chance. And I kind of felt, and it's kind of a variation on the Dream Act, not exactly the same terms, it would be slightly stricter than what the Dream Act would have required. It got overwhelmingly refused. You know, I guess it puts me in the category with Mike Huckabee, because I think even though he's a Republican governor from Arkansas, he had a similar position on children. It's a hard, hard issue. I do think, as I said, there's, let me give you a couple other points quickly on immigration. I think we do need to have stricter border control. I do think you've got to have a rule of law. I think that, you know, the 12 million people or so that are here undocumented, you know, whatever path, the rationalization they're going to have, they can't go to the front of it. There has to be some penalty for it. But I also think a lot of this venom that is playing out, particularly with some folks on the other side right now, you know, is, I think, very un-American in their attitude in terms of demonizing people. You know, that more of that ought to be focused. If we're gonna put sanctions on some folks, we ought to put some sanctions as well on the employers who are hiring folks illegally. You know, and I also have some real concerns about, also even if we were able to fix this issue, about what kind of guest worker program we have going. There are clearly some industries that, you know, agriculture and others that need some seasonal workers, but I am very concerned about us having too large a guest worker program in this country, because I don't want us to be like a lot of European countries where you've got now 5, 10, 15% of the population who are kind of permanent guest workers that are never on a path to assimilation into the society. I mean, you look at France right now, some of the riots they've been having. I want this country to still be a place that if you come here legally, there's a path for you to become an American. Yeah, that's our heritage. We all come from different countries, different backgrounds, and I don't want us to lose them. And I'm afraid a little bit of about a too big a guest worker program that might create that kind of permanent underclass. The last thing that I'll say, and I should be good enough at this point to stop right now, because this is one of the debates that I hope we would start to have, and it is, you may say it defining, but it is a debate that has enormous amount of potential problems, particularly around privacy issues and constitutional issues. But at some point in this country, we're going to have a discussion about how much, you know, if we start to say, as an employer, you should be able to check somebody's legal status, make sure they don't have phony papers and what have you. You know, we're going to have to talk about, at some point, whether you're willing to have a discussion about putting biometric information, for example, on a Social Security card. Now that has a lot of problems. Let me say that on the front end, privacy concerns in particular. But there are three separate strands, policy strands, that I think are coming together that are going to drive this debate. And I'd rather us, rather than kind of burying our head in the sands and waking up tomorrow with, you know, Star Trek type identity cards, think about it on the front. We've got this immigration debate about how you check somebody's legal status. The second strand is, you know, what happens in the event of another terrorist attack. And in the rush immediately after a terrorist attack, when people want to act really quickly, sometimes you act inappropriately. There are parts of the Patriot Act in the aftermath of 9/11 that were an overreaction. But there's a third strand that isn't often put into this debate. I know I'm giving you too long a question. And that is, that I think has to be tied in, and that is the whole question. As we move through the healthcare debate, one piece of healthcare reform that is just crazy that hasn't happened right now is the whole question of electronic medical records and better patient data outcome. You know, what kind of card, soon we're going to carry cards that are going to have our basic healthcare information about us. So if you have an accident or something, they know, you know, what you've got. I've got a daughter with juvenile diabetes. I want her to carry a card that says it's her, that tells her blood type and what her blood sugar is like. So you've got this healthcare identity issue. You've got immigration and you've got security all driving towards a point that says, I think at some point in the not too distant future, we're going to carry some level of identification that's going to carry with it probably biometric information. And we ought to be thinking about that right now and not do it in a rash manner. We ought to be thinking about it in a rash manner. Long answer to your question. I apologize, but it's a very important issue.
This was another issue we were able to talk with Mark Warner about after the event. I wanted to press him on a couple of specifics, in particular, the economic impact that harsh extraction policies could actually have. And Mark Warner shares his thoughts here.
Last couple of years, last 3 years, is my last question about immigration. The Senate's dealt with that, maybe not dealt with that, as a case maybe. A concern that I have here in the Valley, our economy is so dependent upon immigrant workers, and maybe some of them are undocumented, but in the agriculture, agribusiness industries, the poultry industry, certainly, even in the landscaping industry these days is very heavily populated. And I wonder just that there might be a harsh economic impact if we have a policy of extraction that removes people from the economy here.
Well, but that's why, but I think there also has to be some penalty so there's not rewards for illegal behavior.
Sure.
And you've got to strengthen the security at the border. There's been, you know, the percentage of businesses that have been prosecuted for hiring illegals under this administration has dropped off like 70-80%. You know, so the rhetoric sounds great, but in terms of enforcing the law, they don't do it. And what I think it's happening, you know, this is such a hard, hard issue because, you know, people are coming here for a better life, but you got to have rules you follow. And you know, the demonization is coming on the undocumented as opposed to some of the businesses who are breaking the rules themselves.
Sure.
And that's not fair. And I don't want us to turn into this country that has kind of got this hateful, spiteful face to the rest, you know, to the world. That's not, you know, I know in my communities in Northern Virginia, you know, 20% of the new businesses, the high-tech businesses, are all by first-generation Americans.
Mm-hmm. Is there also, just to follow up on that, is there also something we can do foreign policy-wise relating to our Latin American and mm-hmm. Central American neighbors that can also have an impact on this?
Yes, you know, you've got to be willing to kind of engage with Mexico, try to break up some of those oligarchies down there, because no matter how big you build that wall, if you're, you know, at $2 a day in Mexico and $10 an hour in Fairfax.
So you hear there from Mark Warner on immigration policy. Coming up after the break, we're going to talk energy policy with Mark Warner next on the New Dominion Show. The New Dominion Magazine, available in print in the Valley and Central Virginia. Find out more at thenewdominion.com.
For 5 years and counting, the Augusta Free Press, your portal into the Valley. Daily website, weekly podcast, and more. Online at AugustaFreePress.com.
A dull ache. Perspectives on politics from W.R. Marshall. Wednesdays at thenewdominion.com. Welcome back to the New Dominion Show. I'm Chris Graham. Mark Warner addressing really what to him was the most important issue yesterday. It's the first thing he talked about it very much in depth. Energy policy is very much got his attention. As he says, he's the a guy with the zeal of the converted on this issue. Very much so. So let's hear from Mark Warner and his thoughts on energy policy in the United States.
An issue in particular that I've gotten very passionate about, and one that might have this chance to really galvanize people beyond many of our traditional issues, is energy. And let me acknowledge on the front end, this was not an issue that I spent a lot of time on as governor. It is an issue that I've got all the passion of the recently converted on. But I think it is potentially the issue that could do more to fundamentally galvanize all American people across party lines. And it could do more in terms of restoring our stature in the world, could do more in terms of job creation and in security than in our nation's security than almost any other issue. Let me tell you what I mean. Right now, America basically contributes about 25% of all the greenhouse gas emissions in the world, with a very real threat of climate change coming at us full steam. At the same time, we consume about 22.5% of all the world's oil, even though we only have proven reserves of about 2.5%. So we are energy gluttons and greenhouse glass producers at an exponentially higher rate than anyone else in the world. And most people who are Democrats, when they start thinking about the energy issue, normally think about it from the environmental concerns. And let me assure you, I believe the threat of climate change and global warming is real. I believe it is coming. I believe it is an issue that is both a moral, environmental, and absolutely scientific necessity that we grapple with. But I actually believe that we could galvanize the support of the American people to make fundamental changes in this area without even getting to the environmental concerns around energy. I believe we can make the argument about why we need to change our energy habits really based on three other areas: security, America's standing in the world, and job creation. Let me tell you what I mean. Right now, I would sum up our current energy policies as, you know, as simply as could be defined almost as, let's go borrow money from China and then buy oil from countries around the world that don't like us. Now, the fact is, we may be the only country in modern history that's literally funding both sides of a war. While we fund our troops to fight the terrorists, some of the $250 billion that we send abroad to buy oil from regimes that are almost uniformly anti-American, I believe at least, some of those dollars end up in the very hands of the folks we're trying to battle. $250 billion abroad on foreign oil purchases right now, not only to the Middle East, but to Russia, where you see a whole reestablished President Putin that is no longer a partner with America in many instances, but more often viewed as an adversary. How is he able to do that? With a re-enhanced Russia, basically because of America and Western Europe's dependence upon Russian energy sources. I would make the argument that President Chavez in Venezuela has done more to destabilize Latin America in terms of its views towards America in the last 5 years based upon our oil revenues that we pay to him than Castro was able to do in the last 35 years, again, because of our failed energy policies. That $250 billion that we send abroad doesn't even count the additional amount of money that we spend in our Defense Department budget protecting basically these oil runs and oil flows and the transport across the world. So how can we free ourselves from this very critical security concern around oil, number one? Number two, another reason why we need to take on this issue, and I think galvanize folks, is that the rest of the world is absolutely waiting on America to step up. And unfortunately, our administration in Washington just has not been there to be counted. You know, until at least the last few months, was one of perhaps the only major industrial power regime in the world that still didn't even fully acknowledge the scientific basis of global warming. And I was at there's this international conference, and President Rose is familiar with it, that's called Davos each year, where you bring in the business and political leaders of the world, meets in Europe for a few days. And I remember going there last year, and it was like the rest of the world's leadership. And these are the muckety mucks at every level. They constantly say to me, and anybody there is an American, said, when are you guys going to step up on this? And it's almost like they've moved past being angry at us about Iraq. And we're now saying, when is America going to take its appropriate role on the issue of climate? Because until you act, China, India, the emerging nations around the world, there will be no national consensus or international consensus on this issue. And as we think about America's role right now, which you all unfortunately are young enough that you perhaps don't remember, most President Rose and I have grown up, America was always the most respected power in the world. Maybe not everybody liked us all the time, but at the bottom line, we were the most respected. And in so many ways, we have lost so much of that respect, which I think, again, is a security concern and more than about simply popularity, but about our ability to lead over the last 4 or 5 years. If we stepped up on this issue, we don't play it out to the 5-yard line on things like the Kyoto Accords and then walk away, basically take our marbles and leave because we didn't stay to negotiate what could be an acceptable treaty. If we were able to step up on the next generation in terms of grappling with this energy crisis, it would do an amazing amount, I believe, to restore America's standing vis-a-vis the rest of the world. Think for a moment if we could figure out a way that we could find a cleaner and more efficient way to burn coal, capture the carbon that comes out of that coal in the plants that create electricity, and then sequester that carbon. It's called carbon capture and sequestration, and get that right. If we could get that technology right, think about the leverage that would give us with China, which is putting on a dirty coal plant, a new one, every week, and within 5 to 10 years will pass us in the amount of greenhouse gas emissions. So there is a whole issue here around the question of America's stature in the world that means that we should take up major transformative energy policy change. The third area of why we should do this is, quite honestly, is about job creation. I made the comment that when I was before I was in politics, part of my background was I was in the wireless business. And I was one of the two guys that co-founded Nextel. So you may have heard this tired joke before, but so I will be the only speaker that you'll ever hear that actually says, keep your cell phones on, even when I'm talking. Doesn't bother me at all. You hear them go off. I don't hear an annoying sound. I hear the sound of money. So I went from that, and then I went into the venture capital world. And so I've been, before I was in politics, for 20 years I was around IT and telecom. And I would, again, make the proposition that over the last 25 years, what has kept America's economy the most robust still in the world hasn't necessarily been our manufacturing prowess, but it's been our intellectual capital creation and technology revolution. It's been the IT revolution, and we've been the leaders in that. Well, I will make the argument right here that the next 25 years, 10 to 25 years, the single greatest wealth creator, job creator, in terms of a new driving industry, if you were going to switch this debate from politics to, all right, Governor, tell me where you ought to go into if I was graduating, I would say it's the development of alternative energy sources. And right now, unfortunately, while the private market is starting to put some resources into this in this country, we as a nation are doing nothing, or virtually nothing. I'll give you what I think is a pretty stunning statistic. In 2006, the full federal government energy research and development budget is less than $2 billion a year.
You're there for Mark Warner. One more segment to go as far as the show. Mark Warner addressing healthcare, a question from the audience on that, and you'll hear from them on that next on the New Dominion Show. The New Dominion Magazine, available in print in the Valley and Central Virginia. Find out more at thenewdominion.com. Advertisers want to reach sports fans who follow their favorite teams on the Sports Dominion? Contact us today, 540-949-6574 or thesportsdominion@comcast.net. Daily website, weekly radio show, The Sports Dominion. Sports your way.
Everything Virginia, The New Dominion, www.thenewdominion.com.
Welcome back to The New Dominion Show. I'm Chris Graham. Mark Warner addressing a question from JMU College Democrats on the healthcare issue. And he'll share with you. He's not a supporter of universal health care, but he does support a comprehensive health care policy that basically guarantees health care for all Americans, or access to health care for all Americans. So he'll go into detail here.
All right, health care I know enough to be dangerous about. I'm not an expert, but I started a health care foundation in Virginia 15 years ago that's helped 500,000 Virginians get health care. When I was a governor, did a whole plan about with the other governors, got 46 governors to agree on a Medicaid reform plan. Let me frame it and then give you some specific suggestions, okay? First, the health care debate in the last 15 years in this country has been pretty much debated about as a morality issue. You know, it's not right that 46, 47, 50 million Americans don't have health insurance. And, you know, they're right. I mean, I think it's an embarrassment that in the richest country in the world that we've got, you know, a sixth of our population that doesn't have health insurance. But I think if we're going to really make transformative change around health care, and I think we do need this is one of those areas we need transformative change, I think we're not going to win the argument simply on the basis of morality. We have to make it about competition, about how America is going to compete in the global economy. You know, the very automobiles that we were talking about making, you know, it's America made $3,000 to $5,000 more per employee in terms of healthcare costs than competitors around the rest of the world. We're never going to win that economic war unless we can constrain our healthcare costs. So, what does a healthcare plan look like? I got five pieces, and I don't have this is my 37-point plan, or I'm on the Obama plan, or the Clinton plan, or the Edwards plan, or the Romney plan before he switched six times. Here would be 5 points that I think a healthcare plan might include. First, the low-hanging fruit. It's a no-brainer that we ought to have brought the power of information technology to the healthcare system, and that we would have good electronic medical records, good patient data outcome, more transparency in the system. I mean, the amount of duplication that goes on in emergency rooms around this country because person X comes in with something wrong and you don't know what that person's healthcare status is, it's crazy. You know, and that's 6 to 9% of the healthcare costs of our system. And it's not, you know, this is not Democrat Mark Warner. Those are numbers that Newt Gingrich and Hillary Clinton agree on. And the reason why we've been talking about it for 15 years, and this is one area where the market alone is not going to solve it. Unless you can set some, you know, framework, especially in the government's the biggest payer with Medicare and Medicaid right now, we ought to set the standard on, you know, you want to get paid as a hospital or as a doctor, as an insurance company, you got to conform to some level of IT standards. You know, yeah, then let the market create the different tools to get there, but common standards, number one. Number two, you know, I was a venture capitalist. I'm a full-fledged capitalist and proud of it. You know, I think if you take a risk, you ought to get a reward. And, you know, I support people who take risks getting reward in business. But I don't think it's fair or right that basically Americans pay for the research and development for drugs for the whole rest of the world. You know, drugs in our country cost much more than they cost in most of the other developed world. And the reason for that is other countries basically, you know, put price caps on the drugs. Now, I don't think, you know, somewhere along the way, you've got to be able to do the research to create the new drugs. And, you know, the way we're going to solve drug pricing, I believe, is not, you know, the kind of political soundbite solution, let's go buy drugs from Canada. It sounds good, but that's not good. You know, can't make the drugs here, ship them to Canada, and everybody go up there and buy them. It just, you know, it's Econ 101, it doesn't add up. But you're going to have to deal with this issue in an overall way with other countries. This is as much a trade issue as it is a pharma issue about how you lower the price of drugs to Americans, number two. Number three, we got to take long-term care, you know, nursing home costs out of the healthcare system. Right now, we basically fund all the long-term care, and with an aging population, this is just math, this isn't policy. You know, Medicaid, for example, is going to break the bank of almost any state in the country, because that's where, you know, two-thirds of the people of our grandparents who might be in nursing homes in Virginia are paid for by Medicaid. So I would argue that, you know, we at least ought to start a discussion that says when you turn 21, you know, you think about buying some form of long-term care insurance. You know, we've got an aging population, and we're going to have to think about how we fund long-term care differently than currently. Number four, I do think, and I'm not in favor of a single-payer system. I don't believe a big government-run single-payer healthcare system is the right solution. But I do think there ought to be some requirement that anybody that can afford health insurance can at least purchase something. You know, and there are countries like Denmark and others who've got a series of competitive plans, but you basically got a requirement just so you have health insurance, you know, auto insurance, you buy some at least minimal form of health insurance. Because it makes, I mean, again, me crazy. I got friends of mine that when I used to be a venture capitalist, you know, guys making 28, 29 years old, making $150,000, $200,000 a year in some startup company, but they don't have health insurance until they get really sick, and then they're a burden on the system. So some, you know, not government-owned, you know, not government-run plan, but some requirement that you would purchase some level of health insurance if you can afford it. Now, clearly you're going to have to subsidize folks who can't afford it. But we do that already through the most inefficient way of going to the emergency room, which is crazy. And the fifth piece, and this is, you know, this would be attacked from both the left and the right, we're going to have to be a lot more proactive on prevention. You know, we got communities in Virginia where we got a third of our kids in eighth grade who are type 2 diabetes candidates because of obesity and eating habits and lack of exercise. You know, we just, you know, at some level we have to have some incentives and penalties around that, or even if we solve our healthcare crisis, if we then create a new generation of people with chronic diseases, we're back in the hole. But the whole frame of the argument ought to be around competition.
That wraps it up. Mark Warner at JMU on Thursday, and addressing a number of issues as we've been able to bring to you his thoughts on various issues of the day. We'll be looking forward to the chance to do the same thing with Jim Gilmore and Bob Marshall as they tour through the area, and you know, maybe get them on the phone and ask them some harsh questions and make them share with us their thoughts on the issues of the day. But we welcome the opportunity to talk with Mark Warner yesterday. Thank you very much for his time. Thank you for your time as you listen in. Appreciate it. And this will be our last show for this week. We'll be back next week. Until then, have a great weekend, and we'll talk again soon.
The New Dominion is a production of Augusta Free Press. All rights reserved. For more on the New Dominion, visit our website at thenewdominion.com. And look for the New Dominion magazine at a bookstore near you. The New Dominion, everything Virginia.
Want a hard copy of this week's show? CDs are available for $9.99. Email us at augfreepress@comcast.net to order yours. That's augfreepress@comcast.net.